So thanks very much, Michael, for taking the time to be interviewed by Global Voices. Before the interview started now, we actually had a brief chat, but I think it might be a good idea if you introduced yourself, what your role is, and what your background is.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Anik, for having me. My background is, in 2003, I joined the Peace Corps, the first group in Azerbaijan, and I spent 2 years there. Came home and started my graduate degree in international conflict resolution. Was able to secure a Fulbright Fellowship in 2007 and came back to the South Caucasus and worked in mainly Tbilisi for a year, but spent some time in Armenia, Nagorno-Karabakh, and Azerbaijan, and have since returned and started a job at the Center for Social Media in Washington, D.C. I've been here for about a year now, and I've been exploring the connections through my graduate degree work as well as my job between social media, public media, and the prospects for conflict resolution in the South Caucasus.
So you mentioned social media and public media. What's the difference?
Well, the sort of conventional definition I think that's been forming around social media recently is the idea of social networks like Twitter or Facebook or LinkedIn, and they're very much just about sort of the social entertainment aspect, using these media tools to communicate in a very sort of superficial way. They can be used on a more substantive level, but traditionally they're not viewed that way. Then public media is an interesting word. We've been redefining it personally at the center. We're calling something now public media 2.0, sort of a new movement in the United States. But public media is just the idea of sort of media as a way for publics to well, it's sort of a media for the publics rather than a media that is sort of fed from the top down. It's sort of a bottom-up media where you're getting the information that you want as a public.
So is that
makes sense.
So basically that's the same as citizen media. When people talk about citizen media, it's just an interchangeable first word, citizen and public?
Yeah, I would say so. In the States, there's definitely sort of an elitist connotation to public media with NPR and PBS, and you could see it maybe with BBC too, where the intention is to create a citizen media, but what you're really getting is sort of an educated elite that's saying, well, you know, this definitely isn't Fox News, it's educated, but we're still giving you what we think you want. So it's not as democratic, I would say, as citizen media.
So in your studies and how all of this fits in with conflict resolution, I mean, how is development in the South Caucasus region in these areas? How would you assess it?
Well, I think it's bubbling. It's starting. There's something starting. You can feel it, really. I mean, especially with the recent arrests of Adnan and Amin, it's been fascinating from my desk in Washington, D.C., and especially from Facebook, to see all of these friends that I have around the world, in Azerbaijan, in Georgia, in Armenia, in D.C., in London, that are making connections that never had before, sort of amassing together in support of these two guys. So this is actually, I think, a very fundamental shift in this movement of civic media, if you will, in the South Caucasus.
It was interesting. I have in front of me on the computer monitor an article that you wrote, or a blog post that you wrote, where hostile governments meet public media. And in it, you one line you wrote is something about how if Armenians, Azeris, and Georgians ever get together, you'll bet it would be on blogosphere. And I think by extension, we could also say Facebook and Twitter and other online sites. This does seem to have happened surrounding the case of Adnan and Emin, and it's been very, very surprising the amount of connection that's coming together. In a sense, it's formed as a catalyst for bringing people together. It was already there, but it was not as evolved as it seems to be quickly becoming. Is that how you're viewing it as well?
Yeah, very much so. It was a podcast interview you did with, I think it was Arzu, who writes the Flying Carpets and Broken Pipelines, which I read, by the way, as well. Anyway, she was saying something just right along those lines.
I mean, one thing, though, that has been a problem, though, is, of course, if you start doing things openly, and this region is not exactly the most tolerant when it comes to bringing people together. When you start making these connections, other people can also see that you're making these connections, and there could be a reaction against that. I've heard, for example, some people in Azerbaijan, some people in Armenia have had problems when people find out. Do you not see that this could be an obstacle to its further development?
It very much is. That's exactly what Arzu was saying, actually, was that that the arrest of Emin and Adnan is sparking 100 more activists in this field. And so it's a dance that the Azerbaijan government is caught in, that do you stop these people or do you ignore them and act like they're not important? And when you arrest enough people, you know, what are the repercussions of that? What's going to happen? How many more activists are you creating? I'd very much have seen that with, you know, close friends in Azerbaijan who have sort of put their toe in the water here in Facebook, or, you know, in just an email I'll get from them where they'll just mention that they're upset about this or something like that, and then they're off the radar. I have one friend who actually has closed down her Facebook account because of fear of being connected with this. So, and it's a very, very real fear. I mean, another thing Arzu said was that she would rather have truth and be arrested than live under, you know, sort of a hostile government, if you will, that is denying people this right. And I don't know that that is the critical mass at this point. I don't think that very many, you know, the majority of the people feel the same way. I think she's a brave girl.
I mean, I would totally agree with you on that as well. But also another point she made is, and not just about the general mood within the maybe the larger society, but it's also these tools are all very well and good, but a big problem remains access to those tools. And even if you have access to those tools, not necessarily are you going to be using internet, for example, for getting the latest political news, for making contacts, or rather, I mean, some people do solely use it for that, but more on the male-female relationship side, not necessarily for cross-border. So this is a problem as well, isn't it, is basically extending or giving these tools to other voices and them becoming aware of their potential.
Yeah. Mark Howard, who wrote the book The Weakness of, I guess, Post-Communist Civil Society, talks about two prospects for sort of a shift and a strengthening of civil society in the South Caucasus. And one of them, the second that I don't know is hopeful, is that the state becomes engaged. But the first is that it's a generational shift. And I think you're seeing this very much so where and people are saying it. I mean, youth are saying it in the South Caucasus. This is not what we want. So I think as the video games gain more popularity and the ability to communicate back and forth and relationships as well, it will, I think, inevitably come also this sort of citizen media and activism and connection. Now, when will it reach the point where it's actually sort of a critical mass? I don't know. I think education is you know, a huge factor here, and it's not adequate, in my opinion, currently in the South Caucasus. The idea of sort of critical thinking skills and such. I taught English for 2 years in a school in Azerbaijan, and it was, that's a whole other conversation to be had.
Right. I mean, do you think there's a problem? I mean, it was interesting what Arzu said about how, I mean, and I noticed it as well, that suddenly there was a shift away from Russian to English language for blogs, for example. I mean, this is really good, and it reaches the outside world as well, but obviously there should be a role for public media and social media to play within inside Azerbaijan, Armenia, and in Georgia, and presumably in the local languages as well.
Yeah, I would say the South Caucasus Peacemaking Initiative, I don't know if you know of them, but Georgi Vanyan and Luisa Pogosyan, they're a great couple working really hard in this sphere, and their blog is in Russian, and they have bloggers from Armenia, Azerbaijan, and Georgia constantly. They work with Soros Foundation and Goethe Institute's Yachilovec Film Festival that tours around looking at human rights issues. That's one blog. I'm not sure if you follow it, though, in Russian.
I didn't even know about it, but I knew about their projects and I knew about their center. Actually, mentioning Georgi Vanyan, it was interesting. At the end of 2007, he did a Days of Azerbaijan in Yerevan at a school. And a group of pro-government, I would say, nationalist bloggers actually went to disrupt it. And this is another issue as well, is that we can talk about activists, but of course there can be like pro-democracy activists, and there can also be activists who are fighting against some of those things as well. And one thing that I've discovered in Armenia is that these tools are slowly starting to be used by, for example, nationalists opposed to peace. For example, pro-government supporters who are against the opposition. I mean, are you aware of these trends? I mean, I mean, is this the same also in Azerbaijan and Georgia?
Yeah, definitely. I think the sort of blogger to follow on that sphere is Yevgeny Morozov, Belarusian. Uh-huh. Yeah, he's got some great stuff. I mean, he's just all over the world at this point, but he's really looking at that sort of the attack on both sides, using the internet as, you know, internet warfare and such. He wrote one article talking about how he just as a test, he hacked into the Georgian government to try and, I don't know exactly the technical way you do it, but you attack the system so it shuts down. And that was happening during the Georgian and Russian war last summer. It was happening online as well.
So one issue that strikes me in the South Caucasus, especially when it comes to peace building, is that the press is generally polarized, and in Azerbaijan and Armenia, this usually means that negative stereotypes are perpetuated of the other side, misinformation is spread, you don't really get any real news about daily life. Here there is a role for the internet to play and social networking sites.
Yeah, I definitely think so. I think that it's this idea that we have in our publication, Public Media 2.0, and it's the idea that we have the sort of catchphrase that people formerly known as the audience are becoming the media. So this is happening in not only the South Caucasus, but all over the world. And it's that, you know, I mean, look at these big blogs that have taken over in the States, like the Huffington Post. These are citizen journalists, citizen media, who have done this in their free time, that are committed to the truth, and they are filling in this void that has been missing for so long, and they're creating a new network of knowledge. And I do see it happening in the South Caucasus as well. It's clearly happening on a slower, smaller level due to, you know, accessibility, language, education, but it's happening nevertheless.
I'm actually going to be a little bit honest here and actually tell listeners that we had a slight technical problem and we lost actually part of this interview. But one of the things we were talking about during that period that wasn't actually recorded was human interactions. And you were saying that online is not the same as meeting face to face. And I had mentioned, for example, things like Skype that did allow this interaction to happen. But it also occurred to me that when you have a media that is not quoting, let's say Armenian media is not quoting Azeri sources or fact-checking or vice versa, I mean, there's also a role that the internet can play in that as well, surely. If I can interview or if I can speak to someone in Azerbaijan, there's no reason why a journalist here can't.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And with Skype, too, like you said, it changes the game.
And another issue as well is I remember interviewing a new media specialist from Azerbaijan last June at a bar camp in Tbilisi, and he said that it's possible that maybe Armenians and Azeris could actually comment on each other's blogs. What usually happens, though, is when they comment on each other's blogs is that there's a lot of hostility, a lot of hatred. But one thing that has struck me about Facebook, presumably by its very nature, you don't really get that. Everything is in the open, there is a certain etiquette, and if you're using Facebook properly and maturely, those people on your list are going to be like-minded. Related to this is what I've discovered is that when others in Armenia or Azerbaijan see other Armenians or Azeris or the other side actually leaving comments on their friends' Facebook pages, they become intrigued. It changes their perceptions that has been formed by a negative media. This, for me, is possibly revolutionary.
Yeah, I agree. I don't know that Facebook is going to be the ultimate platform that's going to facilitate really increased understanding and sort of a deeper evolution of civil society. I think there's an aspect of, like we were talking about earlier, the social entertainment to Facebook that is in the foundational roots of it. And so it does afford this ability then to be more civil and to have sort of more of an engaged conversation. And I think it is, you know, creating communities that are starting to sort of branch out more and more of their echo chambers. But in terms of it actually being a tool to effectively organize, I don't know that it has the sort of capacity built into it to do that. Maybe it will evolve with time, but there's just some sort of, I don't know if you noticed that, but sort of some fundamental sort of just social lightheartedness to Facebook where if you do get too political on it, it sort of gets lost in the chatter.
I mean, like, again, it's all tools can be used positively or negatively, properly and improperly. And of course, also there has been a move by nationalists and government supporters to also use Facebook. With regards to traditional peace building in between anyone, it can be Georgians and South Ossetians and Abkhazians or Armenians and Azeris, or it could just be regional cooperation. Sometimes I wonder, or I think that it's all very well and good that Armenians, Azeris, and Georgians get together in Tbilisi. But then what happens when they go back home? And this is why I think these tools are also incredibly important, because whilst they can have those face-to-face meetings, they're not particularly regular. And here, Facebook and blogs and Twitter and Skype and ICQ and MSN, they can be used to continue those relationships until the next meeting.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that those are two, and there may be, you know, other elements to it in terms of the effectiveness of civil society forming a new movement to create some conflict resolution or some deeper democratization in the region. I think you can't do it with just, of course, the social media tools. And you definitely, as we've seen over the past 15 years, cannot just do it by meeting in Tbilisi for a weekend every summer. I mean, it becomes just like Facebook, an entertainment. And I've had experiences with these conferences in Tbilisi where it's just, you know, it's a big coffee break and it's a waste of money. So I think both of those combined, you know, is propelling us along on the journey. And, you know, I'm not sure what else needs to be there.
Do you think that those people who are involved in traditional peace building and conflict resolution initiatives are aware of these new tools, or they're still taking them as like some kind of gimmick or fad?
Unfortunately, I hate to be a pessimist, but I see a great deal of the NGO civil society community currently that is working on peace building to be not necessarily very serious about their work, but rather, you know, I think there's a large community that is, they're in the NGO world just, you know, to make a living, which who can blame you? So I think there's a clear sort of radical character or quality that is needed in order to really be serious about conflict resolution in the South Caucasus right now. And unfortunately, I would say that it requires almost a rejection of the current system that's in place. I think when you have those fundamental elements in an activist, in a conflict resolution advocate, then it's going to be a natural sort of move to go into and notice that social media is where it's at right now. And for those that aren't using it, I mean, I hate to be pessimistic, but I feel like they're, you know, either just, you know, older and they just are not, you know, aware of it and not informed or educated, or they're just not interested in using cheap tools when they can get a big grant to keep themselves in business. That's my thoughts there.
I mean, I personally would agree with you, so it's very interesting for me to hear that actually you're of the same opinion. But of course, that raises a very unfortunate question or conclusion, which means that these things aren't going to be very successful until they change.
Until what changes?
Well, until the approach changes, that, yeah. You know, it's not just, I mean, in some ways, I agree you're right. Sometimes I doubt whether or not some people involved in peace building are genuine, or if it is just because USAID or somebody has issued a grant. But another complaint that's been made is that rather than focus on, let's say, Nagorno-Karabakh conflict, the real peace building or the real reconciliation needs to happen on the human level, away from the political side. And here, I think social networking sites could actually play a role.
Yeah, I agree. Especially when the government, in my opinion, are so clearly uninterested in the resolution of it. It just doesn't seem to be. You know, they seem to be profiting from it in one way or another, either politically or economically, or, you know, just the power that they're holding. And anyone that is, you know, working in that system is, unfortunately, I just think, feeding the fire. There's an interesting article by Luong and Weinthal. It's called The NGO Paradox. I don't know if you've read it, but it's looking at environmental NGOs in Kazakhstan and arguing that sort of Western influence after the transition of the former Soviet Union of USAID and other sort of major donors has actually weakened the political civil society movement and shifted them by giving them money, shifted them from their advocacy for things that they believe in into more of a educational environment, because that's what, you know, that's what USAID is paying them to do. It's an interesting thing to look at, the role of, you know, Westerners like myself being involved in a region where, you know, this is not my home. These are not my, you know, at the end of the day, this is not my culture. You have to tread very lightly.
It's interesting you mentioned environmental NGOs, because, of course, we've been speaking about conflict resolution and so on. But obviously there's a role for social and public media to play in other areas. One thing that I think I've been more impressed by, the development of the blogosphere in terms of youth activism in Azerbaijan than I have been of the blogosphere here. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, one thing that has also impressed me here is other voices that have not been properly represented in the media using new technologies, new online tools to actually get their message out. And in particular, I'm referring to gay and lesbian blogs that have emerged in Armenia. And it's been very, very strong. And there seems to have been a knock-on effect. There's a lot materializing in Georgia now. Do you think that when the media is failing to do its job, social and public media can somehow force it to do its job?
Yeah, and I find it fascinating. This is a very cultural issue, I think, where, you know, where the youth are deciding to focus their efforts. I would say personally, just by a cultural analysis, that you know, Armenia and Georgia seem to have a bit more of an open cultural history, I guess. Azerbaijan just tends to culturally be a bit more conservative. And so to make that move into the sphere of gay and lesbian culture in Azerbaijan on the blogosphere is arguably more dangerous than actually moving into the sphere of political dissent. So, you know, like we said earlier, any tool can be used for good or bad, right? And it's, I think that's a cultural thing there, that the Georgians are now following suit, but that gay GLBTA rights are starting to sort of move into the social media sphere. And I think it's wonderful. I think it's fascinating.
But what would be nice would be, I mean, there's also a reluctance here. I mean, I myself have had this experience that, for example, during the 2007 parliamentary election, a number of events that weren't reported in the media, I reported on a blog. And then the news media here picked it up, but they didn't want to actually quote the source. It was almost as if blogs were considered as being somehow irrelevant or amateurish, which is quite ironic given the level of the media here.
Yeah.
I mean, fundamental attitudes need to be changed towards blogs, I think. Do you think that's happening?
Oh, yeah. I think it's definitely happening in the States. I think it's happening also in the South Caucasus. I mean, there is this danger of this sort of triangular legitimacy that's happening where I'm afraid this might happen, and I don't know if it'll have a good or bad effect, but where the West will start pointing to and talking about the blogosphere in the South Caucasus as being a legitimate source, and then that sort of triangular effect will play into the government, and they will sort of by default have to recognize them, even by arresting bloggers, I think is legitimizing the blogosphere in a strange way.
But what do you think, one of the bits that we missed out because of the problem with this recording this call was, I think I mentioned that there were some concerns that governments in the region, and not just in the region, but in Russia, it's happening with calls to ban Skype and ICQ, that legislation will be introduced in order to control its spread.
I mentioned, I guess, Yevgeny Morozov and his blogs that is looking at the threat of the Internet, and the way that governments are starting to use it as a tool to repress the public. It's a fear. It's possible. I think Arzu's point in the podcast you did with her a few weeks back was interesting, you know, the example of Turkey and how Turkey has banned YouTube, but that's, you know, a bit of a joke. There's all sorts of different ways to get around it. The South Caucasus magically, wonderfully, horribly, whatever you want to use, adjective, chaotic. And so that spills over into every sphere. And I think the Internet is one of them. The Internet is already chaotic enough. So for the governments that are already having enough trouble running, you know, their countries to try and take on the Internet, I'd love to see it happen. I think it would be impressive.
Okay, so basically you're skeptical that they can.
I'm hopeful that they can't.
Right, and also basically if they do try and do it, it just basically shines a spotlight on these blogs, sites, and people are naturally interested in actually finding what all the fuss is about.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's a fascinating world we live in where, you know, you have China, you have Iran, where, you know, there are these governments that have just pointedly, they've just done it, and they've suffered some consequences here and there, but it has cut off this development that we're excited about and talking about, this public media 2.0, if you will. And I'm curious what it would do in the South Caucasus if this move, you know, begins to take place, say, in one country and then the other two countries are there to sort of pick up the pieces. It's yet to be seen what the result will be. That's what's so exciting about this, though, is that it is a movement of masses. And so without massive mobilization, there's no power. And what it will take to get to that point is yet to be seen. We're not there yet. So the governments are treading, you know, they're treading water here. They have to be careful.
One interesting, just before our last question, one interesting development that's happened in Armenia is that you're obviously aware of the saga of A1 Plus, the pro-opposition
sure.
TV station that was taken off the air in 2002, still has not been put back on the air despite a ruling by the European Court, despite demands from the Council of Europe, etc. They've started using mobile telephones in
right.
order to yeah. send out video. We talk about social networking sites, the internet, blogs, but online tools accessible via mobile phones are vital, aren't they, because of the huge saturation of mobile phones in this region?
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, exciting. I don't know that much about it. I'd be curious, to see numbers of actually how many people are tuning in.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that as well. I mean, of course,
you
can...
Do you?
No, I don't know that. I mean, we just know that potentially there's an audience that is hundreds, if not thousands, of times larger than those with computers, say. So the potential is there.
Do you tune in with your phone?
Sometimes I do.
Yeah.
During, for example, the municipal election, I was basically downloading their short 1-minute news pieces. And it was incredible, and many people who also did it, they even felt encouraged to be able to see the A1 Plus logo in a moving video image accessible in Armenia without the need for a computer. It was almost like it had got back on air. Of course it hasn't, but there was a thrill, I think, about that.
Yeah, that's great.
Just to end, is there anything you'd like to say about public and social media in the South Caucasus, and also what your hopes and possibly your fears might be?
Well, I would just, again emphasize that what's happened recently with Amin and Adnan has been really heartening on my, side of things over in Washington, D.C., to see so many different friends from so many different sort of connections I've made in the past, over the past, whatever, 5-6 years, making connections in the region, connect together and organize so passionately about something. It's really, really, really been, I think it's a catalyst for something bigger. And I'm proud of everyone who's sort of stepping up and putting their face out there. I think that they're all amazing people, and I can't imagine the amount of courage it takes. And at the same time, I understand the need that they have, and I support them all the way. That's sort of all I would have to say at this point.
Okay, well, thanks very, very much, and I'm really sorry about the technical problem earlier. First time it ever happened, but sorry about that anyway.
No, I think it's a perfect example of what we're facing right now. I mean, it's this technology is very new, and we're on the brink of something here, and that's a great example of it.
Excellent. Well, thanks very, very much.
Thank you, Onyx, so much. I look forward
Cheers.
to meeting you someday in person.